Hi, everybody. It is time for your favorite show on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and we're going to read from the August 2025 issue of The Atlantic Magazine. And we read the feature articles on this show. The Atlantic Magazine show reads the shorter online articles. And this article is headlined, "The Making of Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle: How the Novelists Turned the Violence and Randomness of War into a Cosmic Joke," by Noah Harley. And I don't know about you, but I read a lot of Kurt Vonnegut when I was a younger man, and I love him. I think he's great. So this should be a very interesting article. I'm looking forward to reading it. On August 5th, 1944, the day before the world ended, Frank Sinatra was at a yacht club in San Pedro, California. There, he is reported to have rescued a three-year-old boy from drowning. On the other side of the country, Albert Einstein, the father of relativity, was staying in cabin number 6 at the Knollwood Club on Lower Saranac Lake in the Adirondacks. Einstein couldn't swim a stroke, and in a reverse Sinatra, he was once saved from drowning by a 10-year-old boy. What neither of them realized when they woke up on the morning of August 6th was that at 8:15 a.m. Japanese Standard Time, the first atomic bomb, named Little Boy, had been dropped on the city of Hiroshima, obliterating standing structures and killing close to 80,000 people. The day the world ended is how Kurt Vonnegut described it in his novel, Cat's Cradle, published in 1963. Vonnegut had served in the U.S. Army during World War II and was one of a handful of survivors of a different American attack, the firebombing of the city of Dresden, which killed as many as 35,000 people and leveled the town once described as Florence on the Elbe. "The sky was black with smoke," Vonnegut later wrote in Slaughterhouse-5, the novel that fictionalized his experience. "The sun was an angry little pinhead. Dresden was like the moon now, nothing but minerals. The stones were hot. Everybody else in the neighborhood was dead." The atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima is believed by some estimates to have killed as many as 146,000 people once injuries, burns, and long-term radiation poisoning were factored in, approximately the population of Gainesville, Florida today. I say children because the mission commander, Colonel Paul Tibbers, was 30. Robert A. Lewis, the co-pilot, was 27. Thomas Farabee, the bombardier, was 26. The navigator, Theodore Dutch Van Kirk, was 24. President Harry Truman was on the USS Augusta at the time, returning from a conference in Potsdam, Germany, following that country's surrender. The ship's captain interrupted Truman's lunch to give him a message announcing the attack. That afternoon, Truman attended a program of entertainment and boxing held on the well deck. The ship's orchestra played. The boxing ended abruptly when the ring post collapsed, slightly injuring a spectator. Such was the nature of human suffering that day. Cat's Cradle was Vonnegut's fourth novel. He had started it nearly a decade earlier, in 1954, when he was just 31 years old. It is the story of Jonah, a journalist who has set out to write a book about what famous people were doing the day of the Hiroshima bombing. In the book, Jonah tracks down three living descendants of Dr. Felix Honecker, one of the so-called fathers of the atomic bomb. Honecker is an eccentric scientist who once left a tip for his wife by his coffee cup and would go on to create a substance called Ice 9, which could freeze all water on Earth at room temperature, thus ending the world. Cat's Cradle made about as much impact on popular culture when it came out as Vonnegut's previous books had, which is not to say much. His first novel, Player Piano, had been published more than 10 years prior to little acclaim, and Vonnegut was scrambling to make ends meet for his growing family. After the war, he had made a pretty good living writing short stories until that market softened. Since then, he had worked as an English teacher at a school for wayward boys and as a publicist for General Electric. In a fit of optimism, he had even started a doomed Saab dealership on Cape Cod. An apt word to describe Vonnegut's state of mind in those years would be desperate. Little did he know that Slaughterhouse-Five, published in 1969, would make him one of the most famous writers in the world. Vonnegut was similarly unaware that World War II would be the last war of what historians called the Industrial Age. In the 19th century, steam-powered machines had revolutionized human enterprise. Then, following the development of electricity, came a wave of innovation never before seen. The telegraph, the telephone, automobile, airplane, as physicists such as Einstein and his successors illuminated the very fabric of the universe. Many of those same physicists would later join the Manhattan Project, harnessing the power of the atom and creating the first atomic weapon. In some ways, Little Boy was the ultimate invention of the Industrial Age, which ended a few years later. What replaced it? The Atomic Age, of course, followed in the 1970s by the Information Age. Were Vonnegut alive today, he might say that whatever they call the age you live in is actually the name of the weapon they're using to try to kill you. In 1943, before the bombing of Hiroshima, Kurt Vonnegut dropped out of Cornell University and enlisted in the Army. He was 20 years old. The Army taught him to fire howitzers, then sent him to Europe as a scout. Before he left, Vonnegut surprised his mother, Edith, by going home for Mother's Day of 1944. In return, Edith surprised Vonnegut by killing herself. That Saturday night, she took sleeping pills while he lay unaware in another room. 7 months later, Private First Class Vonnegut was crossing the beach at Le Havre with the 423rd Infantry Regiment of the 106th Infantry Division. They marched to Belgium, taking up position in the Ardennes Forest near the town of St. Vith. It was one of the coldest winters on record, and death was all around them. On December 16th, the Germans attacked. Inexperienced American troops holding the front buckled, creating a bulge in the line, thus giving the ensuing battle its name. When it was over, about 80,000 American soldiers had been killed or wounded. But Vonnegut didn't make it to the end. He barely made it 3 days. Cut off and outnumbered, his regiment was forced to surrender. Vonnegut and more than 6,000 other soldiers were captured. As the Germans advanced, his buddy Bernard O'Hare shouted, "Nein Schießen!" to the advancing German troops. This did not mean "don't shoot," as he thought. What he yelled instead was, "Don't shit!" After a long forced march, Vonnegut and thousands of other American POWs were packed into boxcars. The dark cars smelled of cow shit, and the soldiers were crammed so tightly they were forced to stand. It took 2 days to load them. Vonnegut later recounted how 18 hours after their departure, the unmarked German train was attacked by the Royal Air Force. It was Christmas Eve. Stratified by RAF soldiers and fighters, bombs dropping all around them, dozens of American prisoners were killed by Allied planes. Against all odds, Vonnegut was still alive. The name Little Boy was chosen by Robert Serber, a Los Alamos physicist who worked on the bomb's design. It seems only fitting for a weapon dropped by children from a plane named after the pilot's mother, Enola Gay. 10 feet long and weighing close to 10,000 pounds, The gadget, as scientists called it, was a plug ugly son of a bitch made of riveted steel and wires. Nothing like the sleek, gleaming technology of today. Little Boy was a gun-type bomb, its explosive power triggered by firing a bullet of uranium into a target of uranium. When the projectile and target combined, they formed a supercritical mass capable of sustaining a rapid nuclear chain reaction. That's a fancy scientist's way of saying massive explosion. And boy, it was. Fusion reactions occur so fast that it's hard to describe them using our human sense of time. Within 1/1,000,000th of a second of the uranium bullet hitting its target, a fireball of several million degrees was formed, spawning a shockwave with a blast equivalent of 15 kilotons of TNT that pushed the atmosphere at supersonic speeds, and that traveled outward at 2 miles per second from the hypercenter. The fiery shock was that wave flattened everything in its path, igniting birds in midair. About a third of the bomb's energy was released as thermal radiation, gamma and infrared rays that flash through clothing, burning textile patterns into victim skin and causing severe burns up to a mile away. And the time it takes to say, boom, roughly 80,000 people were reduced to ash, and 4.4 square miles of the city were obliterated. Wilfred Burchett was the first Western reporter to reach Hiroshima after the bombing. On September 2nd, sitting on a piece of rubble, he wrote, "Hiroshima does not look like a bomb city. It looks as if a monster steamroller had passed over it and squashed it out of existence." For clarity, a steamroller was an industrial age machine used for compacting dirt and gravel in order to create smooth surfaces upon which vehicles could drive. And so the world ended, if not in fact, but then in theory. When he arrived in Dresden, Vonnegut and his fellow POWs were put to work in a malted syrup factory making food for Germans that the POWs were not themselves allowed to eat. The guards were cruel, the work exhausting. Vonnegut was singled out and badly beaten. One night, as air raid sirens roared, Vonnegut and his other PMWs were herded into the basement of a slaughterhouse, huddling among the sides of beef as the city above them was bombed. All told, British and American bombers dropped more than 3,900 tons of highly explosive and incendiary bombs on Dresden that night. Vonnegut described it this way in a letter to his family. On about February 14th, the Americans came over, followed by the RAF. The combined forces destroyed all of Dresden, possibly the world's most beautiful city, but not me. To destroy the city of Dresden took hundreds of bombs dropped over multiple hours. To destroy the city of Hiroshima, it all it took was one. This is a cynical man would say is what progress looks like. In his 1967 collection of essays about the atomic age, The Ghost in the Machine, Arthur Kunster, a Hungarian British author and journalist, wrote, "The crisis of our time can be summed up in a single sentence. From the dawn of consciousness till the middle of their century, man has had to live with the prospect of his death as an individual. Since Hiroshima, mankind as a whole has to live with the prospect of its extinction as a biological species." Throughout human history, children have adopted a rule of engagement called "not in the face." Think of it as the first Geneva Convention. Violating the not-in-the-face rule opens the offender up to serious retribution. It is an act of war. Now I get to hit you in the face, or worse. In fact, maybe I should kick you in the balls to teach you a lesson and restore the balance of power. Maybe I need to make the cost of hitting me in the face so high that you never take another swing. If Pearl Harbor was an unprovoked face punch, then Hiroshima was the kick in the balls to end all future wars. Scientists of the industrial age made that kick possible. Vonnegut's relationship with his own children after the war was mixed at best. There would be 7 in total, 3 biological and 4 of his sister's boys, who had come to live with him and his wife, Jane, in 1958 when Vonnegut's brother-in-law, Jim, died in a rail derailment, his commuter train launching itself from the Newark Bay Bridge into Newark Bay. 2 days later, Vonnegut's sister, Alice, died of breast cancer. So it goes. It was Alice who had shaken Vonnegut awake on Mother's Day, 1944, to tell him their mother was dead. Vonnegut considered Alice his muse, and later wrote in Slapstick, "I had never told her so, but she was the person I had always written for. She was the secret of whatever artistic unity I had ever achieved." Suddenly, the house was overstuffed with children between the ages of 2 and 14. For the next 5 years, Vonnegut tried, and mostly failed, to write Cat's Cradle. The stress of supporting that large a family as a writer was still processing trauma from the war made him irritable. Never a hands-on dad, he left most of the actual parenting to Jane, and as the chaos of family life filled the house, he would hole up in his study all day chain-smoking. The slightest noise from the children could propel him from the room ranting. Vonnegut himself had been raised in a house of math and science. His father was an architect. As a scientist, his brother would pioneer the field of cloud seeding. But Vonnegut had a complicated relationship with the word progress. His experience in the war had soured him on the idea that science was exclusively a force for good. Too often, he believed, scientists and engineers focus on the question, can we do something, rather than, should we do something? He saw this when he looked at the Manhattan Project. Though scientists at Los Alamos knew the bomb they were designing was meant to be dropped on people, they rarely thought about the consequences of dropping it. After the war, the physicist Victor Weisskopf, who'd worked on the bomb at Los Alamos, admitted that he was ashamed to say that few of us even thought of quitting. It was the attraction of the task. It was the impossible to quit at the time. The task, he said, was technically sweet. J. Robert Oppenheimer himself used this phrase during the testimony at his security clearance hearing after the war. "It is my judgment in these things that when you see something that is technically sweet, you go ahead and do it, and you argue about what to do about it only after you've had your technical success. That is the way it was with the atomic bomb. I do not think anybody opposed to making it." Nice. Nice, very nice, as Buchanan wrote in his 53 Calypso. So many different people in the same device. Buchanan was the financial founder of religion that Vonnegut invented for Cat's Cradle. A novel as much about the hypocrisy of organized religion as it was about war. Buchanan's first dictum is this: "All of the true things I am about to tell you are shameless lies." Here's another shameless lie. The atomic bomb was dropped to save lives. This is an ancillary thing that war does. It inverts language. See, the lives that mattered to scientists at Los Alamos were American, so they chose to focus on the lives that they would spare. The GIs who would theoretically die in a conventional invasion, instead of the Japanese citizens who would actually die when the bomb was dropped. This made the morality of their actions easier to justify. In this way, they kept things sweet. And yet, to quote a survivor, those scientists who invented the atomic bomb, what did they think was going to happen when they dropped it? Here are some things that happened. Day turned to night. In a flash, the bomb destroyed 60,000 of the 90,000 structures in a 10-mile radius. Of the 2,370 doctors and nurses in Hiroshima, 2,168 were killed or injured too badly to work. This is what the atomic bomb did to survivors. They had no hair because their hair was burned, and at a glance, you couldn't tell whether you were looking at them from the front or the back, a survivor told the New York Times in 1981. Their skin, not only on their hands, but on their faces and bodies too, hung down. In this way, they stumbled down the road, going nowhere, like walking ghosts. Only a few of the survivors were children, as most school-age kids near Ground Zero were killed on impact. This is because at 8:15 a.m. on August 6th, they had gathered outside their schools to help create fire breaks to slow the spread of flames in the event of firebomb raids like the ones that had destroyed Tokyo and so many other Japanese cities. Did they hear the distant roar of the B-29? I wonder. Flying overhead? An air raid siren had gone off as an hour earlier, but no planes had come. So now, when the Enola Gay approached, they didn't even look up. Picture the children of Hiroshima on that sunny morning. Thousands of little haircuts, thousands of gap-tooth smiles, thousands of children trying to be good citizens, wondering what the morning snack would be. This is whom the child pilots flying overhead dropped the bomb on. School children and their parents. What else are we to think? The city of Hiroshima had no real military or technological value. It was a population center chosen to send a message to the emperor. And so it goes. Or as the survivors of Hiroshima used to say, Shizaka ga nai, which loosely translates to, it can't be helped. This sentiment was born from the Japanese practice of Zen Buddhism, an even older made-up religion than Bokonism, Vonnegut might say. And yet, what else can one say about a world in which children drop bombs on other children? In Slaughterhouse-5, Vonnegut writes of an argument he had with his old army buddy Bernard's wife, Mary. Vonnegut has gone to their house to drink and trade war stories, and when he tells them he is writing a novel about war, Mary erupts. You were just babies then, she said. What? You were just babies in the war, like the ones upstairs. But you're going to write about it in that way, are you? You'll pretend you were men instead of babies, and you'll be played in the movies by Frank Sinatra and John Wayne or some other glamorous, war-loving, dirty old men. And war will look just wonderful, so we'll have a lot more of them, and they'll be fought by babies, like my babies upstairs. Later, thinking back on Cat's Cradle, a moral physicist, Dr. Felix Hohnheicher, Vonnegut said, what I feel about him now is that he was allowed to concentrate on one part of life more than any human being should be. He was over-specialized and became amoral on that account. If a scientist does this, he can inadvertently become a very destructive person. Thus, over-speculation is a feature, not a bug of our information age. What are our phones and tablets, our social media platforms, if not technically sweet? They're so sleek and sophisticated technologically, with their invisible code and awesome computing power, that they have become, as Arthur C. Clarke once wrote, indistinguishable from magic. And this may, in the end, prove to be the biggest danger. Because so little thought has been given to the should we to the information age, what will happen if we give human beings an entertainment device they can fit in their pocket, one that connects them instantly to every truth and every lie ever conceived? We have as a society been caught unprepared. If the atomic bomb, riveted from steel plates and visible wires, were an irrefutable proof of the power of science, How is it possible that even more sophisticated modern devices have decreased our faith in science and given rise to the wholesale rejection of expertise? Talk about a shameless lie. And yet, how else to explain the fact that misinformation spread through our magic gadgets seems to be undermining people's belief in the very science that powers them? To put it simply, if the bomb were a machine through which we looked into the future, our phones have become a looking glass through which we are pulled back into the past. Shatika Ganai. After the war, Vonnegut wrestled with what he saw as hereditary depression, made worse by his mother's suicide, his sister's death, and the trauma of war. Unable to justify why he had survived when so many around him had died, and unwilling to ascribe his good fortune to God, Vonnegut settled instead on the absurd. I live, you die, so it goes. If it had been cloudy in Hiroshima that morning, the bomb would have fallen someplace else. If P.O.W. Vonnegut had been shoved into a different train car, if he had picked up a different foxhole, if the Germans hadn't herded him into the slaughterhouse basement when the siren sounded, so many ifs that would have ended in death. Instead, somehow, he danced between the raindrops. Because of this, for Vonnegut, survival became kind of a cosmic joke, with death being the setup and life being the punchline. On May 11, 1955, the Hiroshima survivor Kiyoshi Tanimoto, a Methodist minister, was featured on the American television program This Is Your Life. He had come to the U.S. to raise money for victims of the atomic bomb, known as the Keloid Girls of the Atomic Maidens. Seated on a sofa beside the host, Ralph Edwards, Tanimoto wears a baggy suit and looks stunned. After an introductory segment, the camera cuts to the silhouette of a man behind a screen. He speaks into a microphone. Looking down from thousands of feet over Hiroshima, he says, all I could think of, my God, what have we done? The camera cuts back to Edwards and Tanimoto. Now, you've never met him, the host tells the Hiroshima survivor sitting next to him. Never seen him, but he's here tonight to clasp your hand in friendship. Captain Robert Lewis, United States Air Force, who along with Paul Tibbers piloted the plane from which the first atomic power was dropped over Hiroshima. The camera pans across the stage to the screen, retracts, and Captain Lewis emerges from shadow. Tanimoto steps into the frame and shakes his hand. Both men appear as if they want to throw up. Captain Lewis, Edward says, come in here close, and would you tell us, sir, of your experience on August 6, 1945? There's an uncomfortable beat in which we wonder if Lewis will be able to continue. The camera cuts to a close-up of Lewis. He is unable to make eye contact with Tanimoto. Well, Mr. Edwards, when we left Tinian in the Marina Island at about 8 at 2:45 in the morning on August the 6th, 1945, our destination was Japan. We had three targets. One was Hiroshima, one was Nagasaki, and one was Kurkura. About an hour before we hit the coastline of Japan, we were notified that Hiroshima was clear. Therefore, Hiroshima became our target. The camera cuts to Tanimoto listening, horrified. The social contract of human behavior freezes him in his place. Just before 8:15 a.m. Tokyo time, Lewis continues, Tom Farabee, our very able bombardier, carefully aimed at his target, which was the 2nd Imperial Japanese Army headquarters. At 8:15, promptly, the bomb was dropped. We turned fast to get out of the way of the deadly radiation and bomb effects. First was a thick flash of light we got, and then two concussion waves hit the ship. Shortly after, we turned back to see what had happened, and there in front of our eyes, the city of Hiroshima disappeared. And, Edward says, you entered something in your log at that time? Lewis' voice breaks and rubs his temple, trying to compose himself. As I said before, Mr. Edwards, I wrote down later, my God, what have we done? After retiring from the Air Force, Captain Lewis went to work in the candy business, where he patented various improvements to candy manufacturing machinery, sweet treats for kids. Picture them, all those happy kids. Picture them putting quarters in vending machines. Picture them in store-bought costumes holding out their Halloween sacks. They are no more theoretical than the children of Hiroshima, but unlike them, these children will grow up. They would come of age practicing duck and cover drills, diving under their desks at the shriek of a whistle. Some of an age hiding if the bomb shelters their parents had built, terrified of the theoretical deaths that the A-bomb had made of all inevitable. Nice, nice, very nice. So many different people in the same device. And that was The Making of Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle by Noah Hawley in the August 2025 issue of The Atlantic magazine. And we are about halfway through today's show. And just a reminder, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View. And this is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. And without going into too many details, if you want to go back and listen to this show from the top, just download that Sun Sounds of Arizona app from your tablet or phone. And you can find this one, this show, and several weeks prior in the entertainment section. All right, let's continue on. This whole issue is about nuclear questions and nuclear analysis, so we're going to continue on in that vein. And this is headlined, The President's Weapon. Why does the power to launch nuclear weapons rest with a single American? It's by Tom Nichols, and of course it's in the August 2025 issue of The Atlantic magazine. In the summer of 1974, Richard Nixon was under great strain and drinking too much. During a White House meeting with two members of Congress, he argued that impeaching a president because of a little burglary at the Democrats' campaign headquarters was ridiculous. I can go into my office and pick up the telephone in 25 minutes. Millions of people will be dead, Nixon said, according to one congressman, Charlie Rose of North Carolina. This 37th president was likely trying to convey the immense burden of the presidency, not issue a direct threat, but he had already made perceived irrationality his madman theory part of U.S. foreign policy. He had deployed B-52s armed with nuclear bombs over the Arctic to spook the Soviets. He had urged Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor, to think big by considering nuclear targets in Vietnam. Then, as his presidency disintegrated, Nixon sank into an angry paranoia. Yet, until the moment he resigned, nuclear command and control, the complex but delicate system that allows a president to launch weapons that could wipe out cities and kill billions of people, remained in Nixon's restless hands alone, just as it had for his four post-World War II predecessors and would be for his successors. For 80 years, the President of the United States has remained the sole authority who can order the use of American nuclear weapons. If the Commander-in-Chief wishes to launch a sudden, unprovoked strike or escalate a conventional conflict or retaliate against the singular nuclear aggression with all-out nuclear war, the choice is his and his alone. The order cannot be countermanded by anyone in the government or the military. His power is so absolute that nuclear arms for decades have been referred to in the defense community as the president's weapon. Nearly every president has had moments of personal instability and perhaps impaired judgment, however brief. Dwight Eisenhower was hospitalized for a heart attack, which triggered a national debate over his fitness for office and re-election. John F. Kennedy was secretly taking powerful drugs for Addison's disease, whose symptoms can include extreme fatigue and erratic moods. Ronald Reagan and Joe Biden in their later years wrestled with the debilitations of advanced age. And at this very moment, a small plastic card of top secret codes, the president's personal key to Americans' nuclear arsenal, is resting in one of President Donald Trump's pockets as he fixates on shows of dominance, fumes about enemies, real and perceived, and allows misinformation to sway his decision-making, all while regional wars simmer around the world. For nearly 30 years after the Cold War, fears of nuclear war seemed to recede. Then relations with Russia froze over and Trump entered politics. Voters handed him the nuclear codes, not once, but twice, even though he has spoken about unleashing fire and fury against another nuclear power and reportedly called for a nearly tenfold increase in the American arsenal after previously asking an advisor why the United States had nuclear weapons if it couldn't use them. The Russians have repeatedly made noise about going nuclear in their war against Ukraine on the border of four NATO allies. India and Pakistan, both nuclear powers, renewed violent skirmishes over Kashmir in May. North Korea plans to improve and expand its nuclear forces, which would threaten U.S. cities and further agitate South Korea, where some leaders are debating whether to develop the bomb for themselves. And in June, Israel and the United States launched attacks against Iran after Israel announced its determination to end, once and for all, Iran's nascent nuclear threat to its existence. If any of these conflicts erupts, the nuclear option rests on the command and control, which hinges on the authority, the humanity, of the president. This has been the system since the end of World War II. Does it still make sense today? Here's how the end of the world could begin. Whether the president is directing a first strike on an enemy or responding to an attack on the United States or its allies, the process is the same. He would first confer with his top civilian and military advisors. If he reached the decision to order the use of nuclear weapons, the president would call for the football, a leather-bound aluminum case that weighs about 45 pounds. It is carried by a military aide who is never far from the commander-in-chief, no matter where he goes. And in many photos of presidents traveling, you can see the aide carrying the case in the background. There is no nuclear button inside the case or any other way for the president to personally launch weapons. It is a communications device meant to quickly and reliably link the commander-in-chief to the Pentagon. It also contains attack options laid out on laminated plastic sheets. This looks like a Denny's menu, according to many who have seen them. The options are broadly divided by the size of the strikes. The target sets are classified, but those who work with nuclear weapons have long joked that they could well be characterized as rare, medium, and well done. Once the president has made his choices, the football connects him to an officer in the Pentagon who would immediately issue a challenge code using the military phonic alphabet, such as Tango Delta, to verify the order. The president must read the corresponding code from the plastic card, nicknamed the Biscuit, in his pocket. He needs no other permission. However, another official in the room, likely the Secretary of Defense, must affirm that the person who used the code is, in fact, the president. The Pentagon Command Center would then, within 2 minutes, issue specific mission orders to the nuclear units of the Air Force and Navy, men and women in launch centers deep underground in the Great Plains or the cockpits of bombers on runways in North Dakota and Louisiana, or on board submarines lurking in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, would receive target packages, codes, and orders to proceed with the use of their nuclear weapons. If enemy missiles are inbound, this process would be crammed into a matter of minutes or seconds. Nuclear weapons launched from Russia's submarines in the Atlantic could hit the White House only 7 or 8 minutes after a launch is detected. Confirmation of the launch would take 5 to 7 minutes as officials scramble to rule out a technical error. Errors have happened multiple times in both the United States and Russia. In June 1980, President Jimmy Carter's National Advisor, Zinoviev Brzezinski, received a call from his military aide in the middle of the night, according to Edward Luce's new biography of Brzezinski. The aide told Brzezinski that thousands of Soviet missiles were inbound, and he should prepare to wake the president. As he waited for the military to confirm the attack, Brzezinski decided not to wake his wife, thinking that she was better off dying in her sleep than knowing what was about to happen. The aide called back. False alarm. Someone had accidentally fed a training simulation into NORAD computers. In an actual attack, there'd be almost no time for deliberation. There would be time only for the president to have confidence in the system and make a snap decision about the fate of the Earth. The destruction of Hiroshima changed the character of war. Battles might still be fought with conventional bombs and artillery, but now whole nations could be wiped out suddenly by nuclear weapons. World leaders intuited that nuclear weapons were not just another tool to be wielded by military commanders. As British Prime Minister Winston Churchill said to U.S. Secretary of War Henry Stimson in 1945, was that gunpowder? Trivial. Was that electricity? Meaningless. This atomic bomb is a second coming in wrath. Harry Truman agreed. He never doubted the need to use atomic bombs against Japan, but he moved quickly to take control of these weapons from the military. The day after the bombing of Nagasaki, Truman declared that no other nuclear bombs be used without his direct orders, a change from his permissive non-interference in atomic matters until that point. As Major General Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, later described it, as a third bomb was readied for use against Japan, Truman established direct personal control over the arsenal. Truman didn't like the idea of killing all those kids. Secretary of Commerce Henry Wallace wrote in his diary on August 10, 1945, adding that the president believed that wiping out another 100,000 people was too horrible to contemplate. In 1946, Truman signed the Atomic Energy Act, placing the development and manufacture of nuclear weapons firmly under civilian control. 2 years later, a then-top-secret National Security Council document stated clearly who was in charge. The decision as to the employment of nuclear weapons in the event of war is to be made by the chief executive. Military eagerness to use atomic weapons was not an idle concern. When the Soviet Union tested its first atomic bomb in 1949, some military officials urged Truman to act fast and destroy the Soviet nuclear program. "We're at war, damn it," Major General Orville Anderson said. "Give me the order to do it, and I can break up Russia's 5 A-bomb nests in a week. And when I went up to Christ, I think I could explain to him why I wanted to do it. Now, before it's too late, I think I could explain it to him that I had saved civilization." The Air Force quickly relieved Anderson, but the general wasn't alone. Influential voices in the American political, intellectual, and military circles were in favor of preventative nuclear attacks against the Soviet Union, but only the president's voice mattered. Truman took power over the bomb to limit its use, but as command and control morphed to accommodate more advanced weapons and the rising Soviet threat, the president needed to be able to order a variety of nuclear strikes against a variety of targets. and he could launch any of them without so much as a courtesy call to Congress, let alone waiting for its declaration of war. Should he want to, the president could, in effect, go to war by himself with his weapon. In the early 1950s, the United States created a primitive nuclear strategy aimed at containing the Soviet Union. America and its allies couldn't be everywhere at once, but they could make the Kremlin pay the ultimate price for almost any kind of mischief in the world, not just a nuclear attack on the United States. This idea was called massive retaliation, a promise to use America's great capacity to retaliate instantly by means at the places of our choosing. In the words of Eisenhower's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. When the Soviets launched Sputnik into space in October 1957, Eisenhower's approval rating had already been dropping for months, and he signed off on a major arms buildup, allowing for more targets, even though he remained deeply skeptical about the utility of nuclear weapons. "You can't have this kind of war," he said at a White House meeting a month after Sputnik. "There just aren't enough bulldozers to scrape the bodies off the street." Ike's successors would likewise remain suspicious of the nuclear option, even as the U.S. military relied on their willingness to invest in it. And the system was getting trickier to manage. As the power of the arsenal increased, so did the possibilities for misunderstanding and miscalculation. In 1959, the bomber era gave way to the missile era, which likewise complicated nuclear decision-making. Intercontinental ballistic missiles, streaking around the globe at many times the speed of sound, were more frightening than the Soviet bombers sneaking over the Arctic. Suddenly, the president's window to make grave decisions shrank from hours to minutes, rendering broader deliberations impossible and bolstering the need for only one person to have nuclear authority. At about the same time, the Soviets were surrounding U.S., French, and British forces in Berlin, putting East and West in direct confrontation, making nuclear war more likely, and compounding the strain on the president. If the West refused to back down in any provisional conflict elsewhere in the world, the Soviets would move into West Germany, betting that doing so would collapse NATO and make Washington capitulate. The Americans, in turn, were betting that the threat or use of nuclear weapons would prevent or halt such an invasion. But if either side crossed the nuclear threshold on the European battlefield, the game would soon come down to which superpower is going to launch an all-out attack on the other's homeland first, and when. In such nuclear brinksmanship, every decision made by the president could spark a catastrophe. If he stayed in Washington, he would risk being killed. If he evacuated the White House, the Soviets would take it as a sign that Americans were readying a strike, which in turn could provoke their fears and move them to strike first. In the midst of this frenzy, billions of lives and the future of civilization would depend on the perceptions and emotions of an American president and his opponents in the Kremlin. Presidents decide, but planners plan, and that's what planners do, is find targets for ordnance. In the late 1960s, just before Kennedy entered the White House, the U.S. military developed its first set of options meant to coordinate all nuclear forces in the event of a nuclear war. It was called the Single Integrated Operational Plan, or the SIOP, but it wasn't much of a plan. The 1961 SIOP envisioned throwing everything in the U.S. arsenal, not only at the Soviet Union, but at China as well, even if it wasn't involved in the conflict. This was not an option so much as an order to kill at least 400 million people, no matter how the war began. Kennedy was told bluntly and correctly by his military advisors that even after such a gargantuan strike, some portion of the Soviet arsenal was nonetheless certain to survive and inflict horrifying damage on North America. Mutual assured destruction, as it would soon be called, At a briefing on the SIOP hosted by General Thomas Power, a voice of reason spoke up, according to a defense official, John Rubel. "What if this isn't China's war?" the voice asked. "What if this is just a war with the Soviets? Can you change the plan?" "Well, yeah," said General Power resignedly. "We can, but I hope nobody thinks of it because it would really screw up the plan." Power added, "I just hope none of you have any relatives in Albania, because the plan also included making a Soviet installation in the tiny communist nation." The commandant of the Marine Corps, General David Shroop, was among those disgusted by the plan, saying that it was not the American way, and Rubel would later write that he felt like he was witnessing Nazi officials coordinating mass exterminations. Every president since Eisenhower has been aghast at this nuclear options. Even Nixon was shocked by the level of casualties envisioned by the latest SIOP. In 1974, he ordered the Pentagon to develop options for a limited use of nuclear weapons. According to Fred Kaplan's 1983 book, The Wizards of Armageddon, when Kissinger asked for a plan to stop a notional Soviet invasion of Iran, the military suggested using nearly 200 nuclear bombs along the Soviet-Iranian border. "Are you out of your mind?" Kissinger screamed during a meeting. "This is a limited option?" In late 1983, Ronald Reagan received a briefing on the latest SIOP, and he wrote in a memoir there were still some people at the Pentagon who claimed a nuclear war was winnable. "I thought they were crazy." The Reagan advisor, Paul Nitschke, shortly before his death, told a fellow ambassador, "You know, I advised Reagan that we should never use nuclear weapons. In fact, I told him that they should not be used even, and especially, in retaliation." By the end of the Cold War, the system, though commanded by the president, had metastasized into something nearly uncontrollable, a highly technical cataclysm generator built to turn unthinkable options into devastating actions. Every president was boxed in, a single command, basically, and very little control. In 1991, George H.W. Bush began to hack away at the overgrown system by presiding over major cuts in American weapons and the number of nuclear targets. But presidents come and go, and war planners remain. The military increased the target list by 20% in the years after Bush left office. Since the end of the Cold War, the United States has undertaken some meaningful reforms, including negotiating major reductions in U.S. and Russian nuclear inventories and creating more safeguards against technical failures. In the 90s, for example, American ballistic missiles were targeted at the open ocean in case of accidental launch. If a nuclear crisis erupts, though, the president will still be presented with plans and options that he didn't design or even desire. In 2003, the SIOP was replaced by a modern operations plan called the O-Plan that ostensibly gives the president more options than the extinction of humanity, including delayed responses rather than instant retaliation. But the initial O-Plan also reportedly included options to devastate small, non-nuclear nations, and although the details are secret, military exercises and unclassified documents over the last 20 years indicate that modern nuclear plans largely seem imported from the previous century. The concentration of power in the presidency, the compression of his decision timeline, and the methodological targeting done by military planners have all conspired over 80 years to produce a system that carries great and unnecessary risks and still leaves the president free to order a nuclear strike for any reason he sees fit. There are ways, though, to reduce the risk without undermining the basic strategy of nuclear deterrence. The first thing is the United States could do is to limit an impetuous president and reduce the likelihood of doomsday, is commit to a policy of no first use of nuclear weapons. Vesting sole authority in the president is perhaps the least worst option when it comes to deterring a major attack. In a time crunch, groupthink can be as dangerous as the frenzied judgment of one person. But what happens when a president with poor judgment or a few morals arrives in the White House, or when a president deteriorates in office? Today, the only immediate checks on a reckless president are the human beings in the chain of command, who would have to choose to abdicate their duties in order to stall or thwart an order they found reprehensible or insane. When I asked a former Air Force Missile Squadron commander if senior officers could refuse the order to launch nuclear weapons, he said, "We were told we can refuse illegal and immoral orders," he paused, "but no one ever told us what immoral means." In the end, the American voters are a kind of fail-safe themselves. They decide who sits at the top of the system of command and control. When they walk into a voting booth, they should, of course, think about health care, the price of eggs, how much it costs to fill their gas tank. But they must also remember that they are, in fact, putting the nuclear codes in the pocket of one person. Voters must elect presidents who can think clearly in a crisis and broadly about long-term strategies. The president's most important job as the sole steward of America's nuclear arsenal is to prevent nuclear war, and a voter's most important job is to choose the right person for that responsibility. And that very thoughtful and scary piece was The President's Weapon by Tom Nichols in the August 2025 issue of The Atlantic Magazine. And we are out of time for this week's Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. It's been a pleasure reading for you today, and we will talk to you next week.